So Socrates, it says, okay, what's the idea of piety? You say you know it better than anybody, so if you know it better than anybody, you can say it. So say what it is. And what's the first definition that he gives? He says, well, what I'm doing now is pious, prosecuting my father. And then at the top of the next page, he appeals to the example of Zeus and says, Zeus found his father, and so I'm, you know, punishing my father too. And that's a pious act. And Socrates says, well, wait a second, Euthyphro. I wasn't asking you for an example of a pious act. I was asking you for the idea of piety itself. And so at the center of page 48, he reformulates this request for an idea. Socrates says, do you remember that I didn't bid you to teach me some one or two of the many pious things, but that eidos, that idea itself, by which all pious things are pious? For surely you were saying that it is by one idea that the impious things are impious and the pious things pious. Or don't you remember? I do. Then teach me whatever this idea itself is, so that by gazing at it and using it as a pattern, I may declare that whatever is like it among the things you or anyone else may do is pious, and that whatever is not like it is not pious. So again, he's asking for a single idea, not an example. What he's asked for is the idea of piety, and what he's gotten is just an example of a pious act. But he doesn't want to remain on the level of examples. He wants to move up to the idea of piety, which is what all pious acts have in common, in virtue of which they become pious acts. So Euthyphro then gives his first definition of piety. And the first definition of piety is that piety is what is dear to the gods. It's what the gods like. And Socrates' response is quite good. He says, well, wait a second, though. Don't the gods have battles amongst one another? Don't they have wars and enmities, quarrels?
Yes.
And what are they quarreling about? They're not quarreling about weights and measures or things like that that could be easily solved by appeal to simple criteria. No, they're battling about what's just and what's noble, what's right and what's wrong, what's pious and what's impious. Those are the things that the gods disagree about. So if what's pious is what's dear to the gods, wouldn't that mean that adultery is both pious and impious, right? It's pious because it's dear to Zeus, who's always committing adultery. But it's impious because it's not dear to Hera, who's always trying to prevent Zeus from committing adultery. Which means that the same thing can be both pious and impious at the same time. And that can't be true. That's clear evidence that this is not a good definition of piety, because a good definition of piety would be something that allows you precisely to distinguish pious and impious things, whereas on this account, the same things are both pious and impious. And so he says, well, this cannot be a correct account. So the next definition Euthyphro gives is the claim that, well, what's pious is what's dear to all of the gods. So if the gods can get together and agree that something is dear to all of them, then that thing is a pious thing. And if the gods can get together and agree that something is not dear to all of them, then that's an impious thing. And whatever the gods can agree upon is neither pious nor impious. Now, Socrates doesn't even touch the major problem with this, which is that virtually all the important moral issues would fall between the cracks as things that are neither pious or impious, because those are the precise things that the gods disagree about most vehemently. But instead what he does is he raises the next problem, and here the text gets kind of dense and difficult. And rather than just go through it line by line, I'll just give you the gist of the argument. He says, wait a second, Euthyphro. Okay, say that what's pious is what's dear to the gods. Now, he raises this question. Is what is good, good, because we think it's good? Or do we think something is good because it is good? Those are two alternatives. One is that the first alternative is that good things are good because we think they're good. The other is that we think things are good because they're already good. Now, the first view is what you can call a subjective value theory, which is that things are good because we think they're good. So their goodness derives from our appraisal of them as good. We like them, and therefore they become likable. Whereas the other view can be called an objective value position, which is that things are good in and of themselves, and it's only because they're good in and of themselves that we then like them or think that we're good, that they're good. That is, if we're thinking properly. So which is it, Euthyphro? And Euthyphro agrees that what's pious is pious in and of itself, okay, that it's objectively pious. And therefore, what's dear to the gods can't be what's pious, because the things that are dear to the gods are dear because the gods like them, right? But pious things are pious in and of themselves. So piety is not equivalent to being dear to the gods, even if all the gods agree on it. And the way to understand this is this, and this is a revolutionary point that Socrates is making. What Socrates is doing is he's saying there's a standard of right above what the gods believe. There are objective goods, and these objective goods are objective even to the gods themselves, so that the gods have now something above them to look up to, and that's what's right and wrong in and of itself. And the gods themselves can be wrong, and you have a standard by which you can judge them wrong. If there are certain goods that the gods do not recognize, then you have to conclude that the gods are mistaken, or the gods are immoral. And of course, Socrates uses this kind of account in the Republic to begin sweeping away the whole pantheon of Greek gods, because they're all bad. And his assumption is that if anything is a god, then it would be good. Since the gods of the Greeks are not good, they cannot be true gods. And that is a radical position. And that really does imply that Socrates doesn't believe in the gods of the city. And it also implies that he is bringing in something new that's divine. Something that's more deserving of piety than the gods themselves. And that's an objective notion of good, what's right by nature, if you will, rather than right by opinion, and that stands even above the gods. And so, in a sense, Meletus' indictment is entirely correct. Socrates does bring in new divine beings, but the new divinity is this notion of what's good in and of itself, or right by nature, that stands above the gods. And he is guilty of not believing in the gods of the city, but because by the standard of what's objectively good, the Greek gods cannot be understood as gods, if you believe that gods have to be good. If something is a god, then the sign that it's godlike and worthy of our respect and piety is the fact that it itself submits to what's good. So, in a sense, the gods have to earn our respect by submitting to the same objective moral laws that we do. And if they don't earn our respect, we don't owe them any piety. And in fact, we simply have to conclude that they aren't real, because real gods must be good gods. Even if all the gods agreed on something being good, they could all be wrong. You see, it's not a matter of opinion anymore, right? You see, what Euthyphro's doing is he's treating what's pious as a matter of what the gods opine, right? What they believe. And at first it's just whatever they believe, and then he realizes, well, since their beliefs are contradictory, that would give you a contradictory notion of what's pious. And so he comes to this notion of a consensus. But a consensus is still just common opinion, right? But what Socrates is implying is that what's good is good by nature. It's good because it's good, not because we say it's good. And in fact, we should say that things are good based on their objective goodness. And if we fail to say that, then we're wrong. We're mistaken. And all the gods, if they believe that certain things are good, could still be wrong by the objective standard of what really is good in and of itself. At the time that this is happening, there is an emergence of a kind of monotheism that is urged along by a kind of philosophical rationality that's critical of the mythical accounts of the gods, and moves toward a kind of rational theology, if And my view is that Socrates and that Plato believed in a kind of mystical monotheism. They were certainly atheists from the point of view of their contemporaries, but I don't think they were atheists as such. And this notion of an objective good is equivalent to sort of a god. And in Christianity, the Neoplatonic strands of Christianity, the form of the good or the idea of the good becomes identical with God. And when we look at Plotinus, you'll see a lot of the groundwork of this laid. This is in the 3rd century A.D. Plotinus' Neoplatonism is at work. Christianity was already a very powerful force in the Roman world. And Plotinus, some of Plotinus' students and associates were Christian thinkers, and there was this fusion of Christianity and Platonism going on, and there was a natural fit between this idea of an objective good and the idea of a God that is by nature good. And this is a radical transformation of the Old Testament God, who by any standards isn't good. He's really very wicked. Neurotic, yes, as Jung psychoanalyzes him in answer to Job. This is an interesting transformation that's going on, and it had profound impacts. And by the time that the ancient world and ancient paganism crumbled away, virtually nobody who defended the pagan religion believed in its truth, its literal truth. It was completely allegorized, and at the core of it was a kind of monotheism. And this is why it was so natural in some ways for Christianity to triumph in the Roman world, because the whole impetus of Greek pagan thought from the 5th century BC on was towards a kind of monotheism anyway. So in a way, you're seeing signs of this here. And this notion of what's good by nature or objectively good is really a kind of monotheistic notion. Here we have a notion of a good that's above the gods, the conventional gods of the city, in terms of which we could judge these gods either good or bad. And because there's the assumption that any god, if it's genuine, has to be good, we can come to the conclusion that the gods of the city are not even real gods. And there's a line that Socrates gives that's a really pregnant line. This is on page 47. After Euthyphro talks about how Zeus did this to his father and so forth, where Socrates first speaks, he says, "Is this, Euthyphro, why I'm a defendant against the indictment? That whenever someone says such things about the gods, I receive them somehow with annoyance. Because of this, as is likely, someone will assert that I'm a wrongdoer." Socrates is annoyed whenever he hears gods ascribe evil acts, because he knows that gods don't commit evil acts. Okay, and he goes on, "So now, if these things seem so to you too, who know well about such things, it is certainly necessary, as is likely, for us to conceive them as well. For what else shall we say, since we ourselves also agree that we know nothing about them? But tell me, before the God of friendship, do you truly hold that these things have happened this way?" And the God of friendship is Zeus again. He always keeps it going to Zeus, and it's appropriate given the patriarchal context here. And the line, "We are..." Well, yeah. Yeah, but he says, "We ourselves also agree that we know nothing about them." He's saying we know nothing about the gods. And the "we," you know, could be, as our editor and our translators say, Socrates being humble and referring to "I" as "we." However, I think it's a broader thing than that. I think he's referring to "we Greeks." "We Greeks, except for you, Euthyphro, who know so much, know nothing about the gods." Well, but the trouble is that they claim to know all kinds of things about the gods. If we know nothing about the gods, that implies that everything that we think we know about the gods is not knowledge, that it's false. And so the unstated implication of Socrates' denial of knowledge about the gods is that he believes that what people say they know about the gods is false. So the whole pantheon is swept away with this single line. Of course, it's somewhat understated, but the implication is quite clear. So Socrates is an unbeliever in the gods of the city, yet at the same time he swears oaths by them. And this is very much like Aristophanes in the clouds, right? Who on the one hand has a notion of what's right by nature over and above conventional views and views that are backed up by religious teachings, but at the same time gives credence, or at least lip service, to the gods of the city. And again, the question is, why, if you have an access to an objective good over and above conventional opinions of right and wrong, and conventional religious morality, would you ever continue to pay lip service to these religious small views? And the answer is pretty much the same for Socrates as it is for Aristophanes. Because not everybody is improved by pushing aside the conventional religion. And Euthyphro is a wonderful example of a person who isn't improved by pushing aside religious convention. He is a worse man for his unconventional. Preferring your parents are not just conventions. There's something deeply natural about them and something that's salutary about it. However, if it is the case that he doesn't know what's right by nature, okay, then again, it would be logical to go back to the conventional way of doing things on the simple assumption that if you don't know any better, then you should have at least some, you should be at least open to the possibility that a long-standing and ancient convention might have more wisdom to it than you, your own mind does. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's a real hard one.
Right.
Well, I think that you could come up with the right decision on that matter.
I think that is really hard.
It's very hard, but I think that, you know,
right.
I mean,
you can't say that devotion is
objective. Filial devotion is not an objective standard. Filial devotion, however, can be held up to what's good and judged. I mean, But it's certainly not unconditionally the case. And of course, this is where prudence comes in, practical rationality, because a mechanical application of filial devotion would eventually lead to unjust acts. And therefore, when you get close to doing injustice through filial devotion, you have to have the capacity to look beyond, again, the mechanical rules and track what's right by a different means. So there's got to be a kind of insight into what's good over and above simply following traditional patterns. However, if you don't have that insight,
only the wise see right.
Oh, exactly.
Right.
Well, that's
the whole point.
That's the difficulty. I think that both things are to the point here. They're all in the dialogue for some reason. The real radical stuff really has to do with the intimations of Socrates' understanding of the nature of the gods. But then again, the question is this. If he believes that you can appeal to an objective good over and above traditional religious notions of morality, why, in the very same line, or very same, maybe it's the very same sentence, certainly the same paragraph, where he says that we know nothing about the gods, he swears an oath by the god of friendship. Why is he doing that? It could be needling him in a way by constantly referring to Zeus. However, my sense is that the reasons for Socrates the reasons why Socrates continues to pay lip service to the gods, even though he believes there's a peel above their heads, is the same reason that Aristophanes does. And that's simply this. That even if it's true that there is an objective moral standard that you can appeal to above convention, it's not always the case that an individual person can do that. Most people can. And in the case of Euthyphro, Euthyphro thinks he's better than the many. He's thrown aside convention. And what that's done is it's made him into a worse man. It's made him into a father beater, okay? And a vain fool. And what Socrates is doing by deflating his attempt to think unconventionally and moving him back to the conventional thinking is to make him a better man. However, it is the case that he might encounter other people, and you see these in other Platonic dialogues, where Socrates is trying to loosen the grip of conventional views upon the wise. Why? Because he can see that they would be improved by that. Whereas if Euthyphro were a different kind of man, Socrates would be... You see, Euthyphro is in an odd state, and this is the case with most intellectuals and also most pseudo-intellectuals. You know, on one hand, here's opinion. Okay? And on the other hand, here's what's right by nature. Most people who begin to think will depart rather quickly
from this particular spectrum was right 90. Unfortunately, they just end up wandering around out here in no man's land without any kind of moral guidance whatsoever. And when they occasionally cycle back into the realm of opinion, they start screwing things up and making people's lives in hell, like Euthyphro did his father. Euthyphro was lost in a kind of moral no man's land between conventional morals and what's right by nature. He's got enough wherewithal intellectually to turn his back on the unconventional, on the conventional way of looking at things, to be unconventional. But he doesn't have enough wherewithal to get across the wasteland and find some other source of moral guidance. And therefore, his life is morally unmoored, and his behavior is destructive, both of his family and himself.
Well, it is more subtle, because here, right by nature, right by nature.
Yeah, there is an assumption. There is.
So when you move out of it, you just hover off, not going to other source.
Well, yeah. I mean, let's. If I draw the picture like this, well, there are certain places where they overlap. Right.
In this case, they do.
In this case, they overlap. Right. And so, but anyway, poor Euthyphro is out in the wasteland, and Socrates is bringing him back. Okay, to the conventional view of things, and clipping his wings a little bit, basically. You know, he's better off a little barnyard fowl rather than trying to soar like an eagle. Okay,
but this isn't like his father went out and just randomly picked somebody off the street and murdered.
I know.
There's an ambiguity in here.
Well, this is the lack of subtlety in his mind. He says, it's laughable, Socrates, that you think it should matter whether or not the person is a kinsman. The only thing that matters is whether the person acted unjustly or not. And what one has to do is one has to purify oneself of the taint of injustice, no matter who that person is. Yeah, it's straight thinking rather than subtle thinking. You know, this is just characteristic of his mind. Huh? Well, it's not even so much caught up in the head. It's just like one little part of the head. He's sort of locked. Yeah, his.
The ambiguity in the story that's a bit on purpose to show that if it were a real clear cut case of father truly having done wrong,
evil, yeah.
Yeah. Some innocent person and,
It might be. In that case, you know, the Greek convention of not prosecuting.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to see with that anything.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, if Euthyphro's father were a monster, and Socrates were to know that, I mean, Socrates might have been having a very different conversation about trying to get him to recognize. Well, that just because he's your father doesn't mean that he shouldn't be prosecuted. When we look at Plato's Gorgias, when I do my class on moral philosophy, we're going to see that Socrates believes that not only ought criminals to be punished, but they have a right to be punished for their own good.
Right.
And if we don't punish them, then we're denying them their rights, because true punishment improves the soul of somebody, which is an extraordinary argument. But the point is that the circumstances were different. Socrates would be arguing for prosecution. Socrates, in the Book One of the Republic, takes the idea that what's right is helping your friends and harming your enemies, which is a very conventional notion, and completely overturns that and says, but what if your friends are bad men? Helping your friends who are bad men would mean helping them to be bad. You know, helping your father to be a bad man would be helping him to be bad. Euthyphro is not that subtle. But Socrates would be able to make that distinction. And if Euthyphro's father was truly a monstrously culpable man, Socrates would probably be urging him forward to prosecute him, because there would be a clear instance where the conventions about what's right are out of whack with what's really right. So that's a good sort of foil. But with the Unabomber, well, if he were my brother, I'd have a real hard time. Now, I'm glad they didn't put him to death. Didn't the brother say that? Yeah, the deal was that he wouldn't turn him in unless he could be assured that he wouldn't be given a death penalty. And I think that was the right decision to make. My view is that he deserves to be locked up for the rest of his life where he can't hurt anybody or himself, and given enough pens and paper to keep writing these things, because it
But he's very interesting. Yeah, don't let him get on the internet.
He's a good practice society.
Yeah, exactly. He's a damaged but very intelligent man. And he's not like some punk with an IQ of 75 that, you know, he just like, who cares if they're executed. You can make distinctions like that.
Or you can.
You can make
distinctions. That's the plan of
okay, now.
What's that? Well,
at least you had the guts to say.
Well, the tapes were running.
Yeah.
What the hell? Bobby Bull.
Oh, well, I don't know who said that. I think I might have said it. Every new generation is an invasion of barbarians. I keep saying that. And I think the other week I was at this discussion group. We were reading a page of Finnegan's Wake at the Institute for Eco-Studies. And some guy, a nice enough fellow, but he's the kind of person who earnestly lays out something that's just painfully obvious, as if he's just discovered this for the first time. Yeah, he does this all the time, and you know, and you don't quite know how to treat him after a while. And at one point he said, Santayana said, those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. And I said, or, as I like to say, those who don't learn from history are condemned to have Santayana repeated to them. You know, and I thought, did I just make that up, or did I hear somebody else? I don't know. Well, it's on the tape, so anyway, it's preserved for posterity, for better or for worse. So anyway, he comes up with another definition after Socrates makes it very clear that the idea that the pious is what's loved by or dear to the gods. And so he comes up with another definition, and basically piety is tending to the gods. And it's a kind of commerce between gods and mortals. And Socrates says, well, what do the gods get out of this? Are we improving the gods like we improve dogs? We take care of them, or horses, we take care of them. And Euthyphro says, well, certainly not. We don't benefit the gods. They don't need anything from us. And so Socrates says, well, what kind of tending is this? And finally, he just gets down to basically saying that, well, let's just go to page 59. Euthyphro, a little ways down on 59, there's a paragraph there, where it says be in the margin, 59. Euthyphro gives a fifth definition, right? A fifth attempt at a definition. It says, I also told you a little while ago, Socrates, that to learn precisely how all these things are is a rather lengthy work, namely how all these things are with the gods. However, I tell you simply that if someone has knowledge of how to say and do things gratifying to the gods, by praying and sacrificing, these are the pious things. And this is his, in a sense, his fifth attempt at a definition, which is just an example, again, of pious things, when you get right down to it. And then he goes on, and such things preserve private families as well as the communities of cities. The opposites of the things gratifying are impious, and they overturn and destroy everything. And Socrates says, you could have told me much more briefly, Euthyphro, if you wish, the main point of what I was asking. But you were not eager to teach me, that is clear. For you turned away just now, and you were at the very point at which, if you had answered, I would already have learned piety sufficiently from you. But as it is, for it is necessary that the lover follow the beloved wherever he leads, again, what do you say the pious and piety are? Isn't it a certain kind of knowledge of sacrificing and praying? Yes. Now, what I find very interesting about that passage is that Socrates says, you turned away just now, when you were at the very point at which, if you had answered, I would already have learned piety sufficiently from you. Now this is very interesting because it indicates that Socrates had a pretty good idea what piety is. And he thinks, and Euthyphro almost got there, but then turned away at the last minute. So this is very clear indication that Socrates is being entirely disingenuous when he says, teach me piety, wise Euthyphro. Okay. But what is this thing that Euthyphro has turned away from? At the very brink of giving a definition of piety? That's an interesting question. I think it's stated explicitly in what Euthyphro says. Now let's look at what he says. However, I tell you simply that if someone has knowledge of how to say and do things gratifying to the gods by praying and sacrificing, these are the pious things. And such things preserve private families as well as the communities of cities, the opposites of the things gratifying or impious, and they overturn and destroy everything. If you look at what he says here, and subtract from it the things that Socrates clearly rejects, he rejects everything. He would reject everything, and he does reject everything, that says that piety is a matter of doing what's gratifying to the gods. Because he immediately goes on to show that that's nothing more than saying what's pious is what's dear to the gods, and didn't we already agree that that's what piety can be, and haven't you just turned and cut this around in a circle? So if you cross out all of that, the only thing that's left is such things preserve private families as well as the communities of cities. That's the only thing that's left. And that, I think, is exactly what Socrates believes that piety is. This is the function of piety as far as Socrates is concerned. Private families and communities of cities. Well, look at the Republic, right? The city and the Republic is based on the destruction of the family. So I think that there can be cities, there are tensions between the city and the family, okay? And piety somehow preserves both. So I don't think there are necessarily a redundancy there. But as far as Socrates is concerned, piety, the role of piety is precisely to preserve private families and cities. Well, let's just take a step back and ask ourselves again. Given that we can infer that Socrates and Plato do not believe in the gods of the city, what they're really saying is that people's pious belief in gods that they don't think are real is still a good thing. Why? For the simple reason that it preserves private families and cities. It's a tool of moral and political education. And the fact of the matter is that people can be made better by beliefs in false gods.
So they're creating a god to help preserve our city?
Well, that's not exactly the claim, because clearly the gods didn't come about in order to do that, right? But the point is that however belief in the gods does come about, the fact is that over very long periods of time, as all the different forces in societies accommodate one another and adjust to one another, clearly those gods and those religious practices that are conducive to the survival of a society will come to predominate, and the ones that aren't will disappear. And therefore, through a kind of evolutionary process of adjustment between different forces in society, what religion tends to do is it tends to have a preservative force. And that can often be quite contrary to the teachings of the religion itself. Certain teachings will be just simply ignored, and others will be brought forward because they're socially useful. So, for instance, certain religious groups like Shakers that practiced complete celibacy have almost become extinct. Why? Because their form of piety does not preserve families and cities, okay, and their communities have almost completely disappeared. Whereas other forms of religion, say, be fruitful and multiply and so forth, those tend to survive. Okay? So there's this kind of naturalistic look at the sociological function of religion. Even religions that aren't true, and they can't all be true, the fact of the matter is that they maintain themselves to the extent that they're consistent with maintaining the overall health of a society. And this is the extent to which Socrates thinks that piety is a valuable thing. However, he's also quite able to recognize those aspects of traditional religions that aren't conducive to the preservation of the family and the state. And how can he recognize that? Because he has a higher standard to look to, the standard of natural right. And so on the one hand, he's willing to tinker around with, erase, reform, censor, whatever you want to say, certain aspects of the traditional religion that lead people to behave badly. But on the other hand, he's completely willing to keep all those aspects of the traditional religion, the traditional piety, that make people better than they otherwise would be. And this, for Socrates, is the whole purpose of piety. This is its function. And from the point of view of nature, of natural life, this is what validates it. This is what makes piety good. And this is pretty much the view of the clouds. This is why the clouds, you know, recognize the god of the city. Because in the clouds he didn't.
Yeah,
but now he does.
Yeah, now he does. So yeah. Now he can steer
Isn't it picking and choosing God?
Yeah.
You're not really being objective about
it. Or you're being very objective. Yeah. If you look at any religion, you will find that those dimensions of the religion that are conducive to civilized life tend to be the ones that responsible priests and preachers bring to the fore, and emphasize. And those that are inconsistent tend to be pushed to the background. If you look at Christianity in its earliest forms, it was a totally apolitical religion. Right? There's render unto Caesar what's Caesar's, and unto God what's God's. That the early Christian followers had completely given up the essentially political nature of Judaism. Judaism is a political religion. It demands the foundation of a state on the basis of the revealed law. And this is why, and it's an extraordinarily hardy idea. In fact, Jews who don't even believe in the revealed law became Zionists who are adamantly for a Jewish state. It's the same with Islam. If you put the Old Testament and the Quran side by side, there's a continuity between the two as far as styles of religion are concerned that is far greater than the continuity that you find between the Old and the New Testaments, or the Old Testament, or the New Testament and the Quran. Christianity began as a completely apolitical religion. But after three centuries, suddenly it was the official religion of the Roman Empire. And what had to happen at that point were that the fathers of the church who realized what was going on suddenly had to make it into a political religion. They still maintained a separation between divine law and civil law, a separation of church and state that was there from the very beginning. But at the same time, there was an attempt to accommodate the moral teachings of Christianity to the necessity of political life. And so, for instance, the recognition that virtue is necessary and nobility is necessary to maintain political life, which are pagan notions, there was an attempt to accommodate that to an essential egalitarian ethic that you get out of Christianity. And it was a very subtle thing. You look at St. Augustine, you look at St. Thomas Aquinas, and it was a remarkable, perhaps unstable, synthesis that they tried to formulate, but it was very clearly an attempt to bring to the fore those aspects of Christianity that were consistent with civilized political life and to take away those aspects that weren't. And that is true of almost every religion that functions. It accommodates itself to the necessity of preserving families and cities. Throughout most of the early Christian era, family life was condemned, heartily condemned, as an excessive attachment to the world. And it was only after Christianity became the state religion that it became more accommodating to the necessities of the survival of the human race. It's an extraordinary transformation that took place, and this is the case with any religion that survives. It has to. As well, put it this way, there are many religions that haven't survived because they've extinguished the societies that encase them. But even within the city-state, there were always tensions between the family and the state. You can see this in Antigone, for instance, right? And so, sometimes put it this way, the preservation of one gets in the way of the health of the other. And this is really the basis of most Greek tragedies, precisely the tension between family and polis. And it was never really fully resolved. Aristotle's Politics is an attempt to try and resolve it, but it ultimately becomes unresolved, and there's a recognition that this is sort of a permanent possibility. One of the things that caused an enormous amount of upset in the Greek city-state was factionalism, which were based on pre-political allegiances, ultimately to families, extended families, clans, and so forth. And so this was a factor that was constantly being negotiated. So, the health of the city was often inimical to the health of these pre-political kinds of orders. So what's good for the state is not necessarily good for the family. What's good for the family is not necessarily good for the state. The best situation is where they're both happy. But you're always going to find instances or situations where people are going to be torn between these conflicting loyalties. And the craft of the statesman is not to eliminate that, because that's going to be a permanent fixture of human nature, but simply to try and adjust things as well as possible so that the frictions are not so bad that they cause the breakdown of one sphere or the other. And if you look at someone like even Hegel, you know, in his philosophy of right, again, it's a delicate balancing act to try and fit together the different realms of society, the family, the state, and what he calls civil association, because each one of them requires the other to work, but each one of them also has a tendency to totalize itself and overwhelm the others. And so they're in a sort of unstable situation of where they all depend on one another, yet they left to their own devices, they would all swamp one another. The sixth definition that Euthyphro attempts, it's actually attempted by Socrates. It's on page 60, below where it says E in the margin, between where it says E and 15a on page 60. Socrates says, then piety, Euthyphro, would be a certain art of commerce for gods and human beings with each other. And again, he asks, but what do the gods get from it? And he says, well, they get what's dear to them. They get praise, they get gratitude, and so forth, and that's what we give them. And Socrates says, well, you know, isn't that what we've already rejected, the idea that the pious is the dear to gods, and so we've come around as a circle. And then on page 61, just above where it says D in the margin, there's this long quote from Socrates. Socrates says, all right, Euthyphro, one more time from the top. Okay. Socrates, then we must consider again from the beginning what the pious is, since I will not voluntarily give up out of cowardice until I learn it. Do not dishonor me, but apply your mind in every way as much as possible and tell me the truth now. For if, in fact, any human being knows, you know, and you do, and like Proteus, you must not be let go until you tell. For if you didn't know plainly the pious and the impious, there is no way that you would ever have attempted to prosecute an elderly man, your father, for murder on behalf of a hired man. Rather, as to the gods, you would have dreaded the risk that you would do it not correctly. You would not do it correctly. And as to human beings, you would have been ashamed. But as it is now, I know well that you suppose that you know plainly the pious and the not pious. So tell me, Euthyphro, best of men, and don't hide what you hold it to be. Some other time then, Socrates, for now I am in a hurry to go somewhere, and it is time for me to go away. What Socrates says here is look, Euthyphro, if you don't know what the pious is better than anybody else, then you would not prosecute your father. You would never dare risk it. But since you're prosecuting your father, I know that you must know. But of course, Euthyphro has now come to the realization that he doesn't know any better, and he's left to draw the conclusion that maybe he shouldn't risk prosecuting. And so he makes a hasty exit. Apparently, he's not sticking around the law court to pursue the lawsuit against his father. He's leaving. And it is comic. And of course, this dialogue is a kind of dry philosophical comedy. And then Socrates says, such things you are doing, comrade, by leaving you are throwing me down from a great hope I had, that by learning from you the things pious and the things not, I would be released from Miletus's indictment. For I hope to show him that I have now become wise in the divine things from Euthyphro, and that I am no longer acting unadvisedly because of ignorance or making innovations concerning them, and especially that I would live better for the rest of them. Again, he's pouring on the sarcasm. But the fact of the matter is that Socrates does know what piety is. And it's pretty much the conventional notion of piety that the Greeks have. Because again, the Greeks were less concerned about whether people actually held correct opinions about the gods, I mean, believed in them or not, but simply that the religious institutions functioned for the preservation of the state and family. And Socrates is all for that. He thinks that is the only correct definition of piety as far as he's concerned. But at the same time, he's maintaining his intellectual liberty to think otherwise about the gods, to hold contrary opinions based on his understanding of what's right by knowing. So, the Euthyphro is a lovely response to the clouds. You're getting a picture of Socrates behaving exactly the opposite of the Socrates of the clouds. And he's behaving exactly the opposite of the Socrates of the clouds on the basis of the very philosophy that I think you can see in the clouds. And so this is another sort of tribute to the Aristotelian influence on the formation of Socratic philosophy. So this is our third little comedy that we've looked at in the class. And the next dialogue, too, has certain comic dimensions to it, and that's the apology of Socrates to the jury, which is Socrates' defense speeches at his trial. But the apology is a marvelous text, and let me just give you a hint as to how to read it. Every time Socrates denies one of the charges against him, he covertly affirms that there's actually some basis to it. Every single denial contains a covert affirmation or admission of the truth of the charge. Now, of course, the charge isn't true now, but it was true earlier. It was true about Socrates of the clouds. But Socrates can't defend himself on the basis of a fine distinction of saying, yes, I was this bad person like you see in the clouds, but I'm better now. Believe me, trust me. He can't do that. It just doesn't work. The worst sort of defense in a trial is the yes, but defense. Yes, I did murder the person, but... Because no one's going to hear anything after you've admitted it. Socrates realizes that he can't give a yes, but defense. And so he's defending his entire life, and he's saying he's entirely blameless. At least that's the surface of the text. But if you look at it more carefully, you see that he's covertly affirming that there's essential truth to the charges against him. And the misfortune, of course, is that people are not subtle enough to take a yes-but defense. And so poor Socrates gets